I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The U.S. Constitution calls for representation in the House to be based on population. So every 10 years after the census is taken, each state looks at how its districts are drawn. It sounds simple, but through a process known as gerrymandering, redistricting has become a way for parties to control political power within states. It's happening in Missouri, which we'll consider today, as this issue has found its way to the nation's Supreme Court. Then we'll bring back our conversation with Keyser Khan. This Gold Star father tells his story of coming to America from Pakistan and ending up on stage at the Democratic National Convention. We'll close with a look at sports with Greg Eklund. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Here's a politically loaded word for you, gerrymandering. The term refers to the practice of gaining seats for a political party based on how the lines are drawn for, you know, say, congressional districts or even state senate districts. The practice of seeking an edge this way dates back to the earliest days of the Republic. Now the U.S. Supreme Court is looking at states that have engaged in the practice, and the decision could have sharp implications for Missouri and Kansas. Here to talk about gerrymandering and how can a state ensure the fair drawing of district boundaries are Jason Rosenbaum. He's a reporter with the St. Louis Public Radio who's a frequent guest on this show. Jason, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Dave Robertson is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Dave, nice to have you as well.
Hi, happy to be here, Steve.
Dave, let me start with you. This concept of gerrymandering and redistricting, where district lines get redrawn once a decade, may sound like some, you know, arcane aspect of the political science world, but in reality, this is a very, very, very big deal. Explain to us why.
It's a practice of drawing lines in a way that packs together party's opponents or cracks a district that has a lot of your opponents in it and spreads them across your own supporters' district. So it can really help a party pick up some seats in the legislature, and that helps them pick up power.
There's no question, is there, Jason, that both parties engage in this practice of gerrymandering and trying to gain political advantage, right?
I think that's fair. Most of the gerrymandering that went on after the last census were done with Republican legislatures because Republicans control most of the state legislatures throughout the country. But it should be emphasized that in states where Democrats control the process, like Illinois, there was widespread gerrymandering both on a congressional and a state legislative level. In Missouri, legislators draw congressional districts, and Republicans control that process, so you have a map in Missouri with more Republican congressmen than Democrats. However, the state legislative process in Missouri is done through a bipartisan commission, which for all intents and purposes always deadlocks, and judges typically draw the state House and the state Senate districts. For your listeners, judges drew the state House districts after the last census. A second bipartisan commission ended up drawing the state Senate districts.
Jason, are the two political parties in Missouri already planning on the next redistricting process, which I guess isn't that far away now?
I haven't talked with them extensively, but as far as the congressional districts are concerned, if the Republicans have a supermajority in the legislature still, like they do now, it honestly really doesn't matter whether there's a Democratic or Republican governor. The Republicans will hold pretty much all the cards because they can override a gubernatorial veto for congressional districts. For state legislative districts, as I'm sure we're going to get to in a minute, there is an initiative petition that is being circulated that would pretty dramatically change that process. And I definitely think both parties are paying attention to it for different reasons.
How would the petition change things?
Well, it would keep the bipartisan commission in place, but it would create a demographer that would draw the House and the Senate maps. That demographer would be chosen through a process where the auditor presents candidates to the majority leader and the minority leader of the Senate. Those two political leaders can then reject a demographer candidate, and then a random lottery is chosen to pick who the demographer is. That demographer would then have pretty much a lot of power to end up drawing the lines, because the commission could change the recommendations that come from the demographer, but it would require 7/10 vote. And I have actually notes here. The demographer would be tasked with drawing districts that are based off partisan fairness and competitiveness. And the districts would still have to be contiguous, but it encourages like square, rectangular, and hexagonal shapes. Hmm. So the idea basically is to create legislative districts that are more competitive. Whether that actually happens, though, I think is an open question, because as I'm sure the professor is about to explain, the state's Democratic and Republican populations are heavily concentrated together, essentially, especially on the Democratic side. So you would have to draw some pretty interesting districts to make, for example, legislative districts in rural Missouri competitive.
Right.
Dave,
that's
I was just going to have you explain that, because in Missouri particularly, and in a lot of states, I guess it goes without saying, how can you draw, you know, districts that are fairly competitive when, broadly speaking, you have so many Democrats packed into Kansas City and St. Louis that, you know, to spread those Democrats out, as Jason just said, would require the shapes of districts to look really strange?
Well, I think the top agenda item for the demographers to make sure all the populations are identical or as close as possible, then he would have or she would have to meet the requirements of the Voting Rights Act. So that sets some limits on how you can design these districts. Having said that, there are lots more Democrats concentrated in small geographical areas than there are Republicans concentrated in those areas. So it's really hard at this point to draw a map that would give, for example, Democrats as many representatives as Republicans, because there's a majority of Republicans in the state. What this is aimed to do is to reduce the possibility that if Republicans get 55% of the vote, they would get, say, 70% of the representatives. That's what you see in a really seriously gerrymandered state like Pennsylvania or like North Carolina in particular. And that's what this aims to prevent. The idea is to accomplish something called efficiency. When people in a district like St. Louis City, the first House district, U.S. House district in Missouri, cast votes, their votes, if they were distributed to candidates in other districts, would help a Democrat become more competitive. In this case, because they're packed into one district, those votes are, in a way, wasted. That's true for a Republican area as well. And the idea is to try to get the balance of wasted votes as low as possible. That's what the demographer's challenge is going to be.
Again,
try to eliminate those votes.
You know, not to belabor the point, Professor, and you're explaining this so well, but you know, Republicans are more evenly spread out across a state like Missouri and Kansas, for that matter, as we're talking here on the state line. So how can you possibly draw districts that have as few, in your term, wasted votes as is being aimed at as the goal here?
You can reduce the percentage that's wasted. That's what the aim is, to reduce it so that it's close. It doesn't have to be exactly on target, so that it's close to being a percentage that represents the percentage of votes statewide, so that if 55% of the people vote for Republicans, about 55% of the people who represent them should be Republicans. You're not going to achieve that because of the geography, which is much more important than the way the district lines are drawn. And the other part of this that matters is incumbency. Incumbents generally win re-election. They have big advantages over people who are challenging them or the two challengers in an open seat. So between geography and incumbency, the ability of a demographer to come in and make these districts perfectly balanced is really unlikely. But that demographer can cut the margin.
Jason Rosenbaum, maybe the bottom line question here is, can the districts in a state like Missouri be drawn in such a way that Democrats once again would have a shot at majority control of both the state House and the state Senate?
I think that their issue is beyond redistricting. I think if Democrats want to get beyond their superminority status, they have to do better in rural Missouri. I've said that like 100 times, and I'm going to say it 100 more times. And it doesn't really matter how the redistricting process goes forward. If Democrats are getting 20% in rural counties, they're going to be in the superminority every single time.
I completely agree with Jason, and it's true across the country, Kansas, everywhere else.
And I think that's something we need to really, really hone in on when we're talking about this Clean Missouri initiative is this only involves state legislative districts. It does not involve congressional districts. I assume they did that because you would have to amend multiple parts of the Constitution, which you can't do. And I think that there is pretty much no question that the congressional districts in Missouri were gerrymandered to help both incumbents and Republicans. I have not gotten definitive convincing evidence that the judges in the House district drew the House district purposely to help Republicans, or that the commission drew the Senate map to help Republicans. There were also instances in the Senate map where Republican incumbents were ousted from their seats, like Senator Jane Cunningham lost her seat outright. Senator Jim Lemke in South St. Louis County received a much more Democratic district. And Jill Shoup was able to take over a Republican district after it was drawn to be Democratic. I would say that map was a wash between the both parties, and it didn't really help either one tremendously. But they both ended up being Republican maps because, as I mentioned before, the state of Missouri has a lot of rural parts, and Democrats have done worse and worse in those areas. So I think that if Democrats want to be on a better level, it's not a redistricting question. It's a messaging question, right, and it's an ability to connect with outstate Missouri, which I know they're making a concerted effort to do, but I think that that has to be their focus as opposed to drawing lines.
Professor
so to speak.
Robertson, going back to my first question I asked you about what a big deal this is, just the notion that we have an initiative petition process underway that would change the way we redistrict speaks to just how important all this is, right?
Right. And I think it shows a kind of a gap between what citizens think and what the reality is on the ground with these district lines. I think there's a lot of people, very well-informed people, too, that think gerrymandering is at the bottom of the Republican successes in a state like Missouri. And I totally agree, again, with Jason, that that's not the case, that geography, that partisan competitiveness, that incumbency, those are the things that matter a lot. But for me, so many people feel that gerrymandering is the problem, and there's good evidence that it is a part of the problem, then, but not a big part in this state, that the legitimacy of our government really gets eroded a little bit when people think politicians are manipulating everything. Mm-hmm. So this is as much a legitimacy question from my point of view as it is an actual fixing the system question.
I was going to say, Jason, as we're talking here, Republicans dominate the General Assembly and the congressional delegation. So can we assume then that Republicans are better at redistricting than Democrats? Or to your point, is it more that the GOP philosophy is just simply selling better in a state like Missouri?
Well, I mean, they clearly were better at redistricting in 2011 because they were able to override Governor Jay Nixon's veto of that congressional map because they had enough Republicans and supportive Democratic allies to do that. Again, though, for the state legislative districts, legislators play an indirect role in that process in the sense that they can go to these commissions and say, I want my district to be like this. But more often than not, those commissions have ignored them and just drawn districts however they want it to. In the last, especially in the House map, there were probably, I don't know the exact number, but several dozen legislators that were pitted against each other after the last redistricting. That included Democratic lawmakers and Republican lawmakers. Now, most ended up moving to different districts and not running against each other, or one person decided not to run again. There were instances, though, where incumbents did run against each other, which shows that, especially on the House map, I don't really think that map protected incumbents that well. If it did, you wouldn't have had so many instances where sitting lawmakers were put in the same districts. And some of that is the results of just population loss, possibly. Right. I can't really peer into the souls of how the judges ended up drawing those districts. I think there's a lot of conjecture about how it happened. Some would argue that they took the Republican suggestions more than the Democratic ones, but there's no evidence of that because the judges didn't explain their decision making. And I mean, that could be one of the reasons why the Clean Missouri Initiative kind of moves away from the judges being involved with that process and maybe has either the demographer or the commission play a larger role, because at least in that setup, it does provide the public with more insight on how and why these districts were drawn the way they were.
Let's go to some phone calls here, 816-235-2888, as we talk about gerrymandering and redistricting in both Kansas and Missouri that happens once a decade. The process is just a few years off here in both our states. Richard from Overland Park, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Steve, I really appreciate your show. It always speaks to issues that never seem to come up, so
good.
Thank you for that. I understand conceptually gerrymandering. What I don't understand is logistically, is there not sufficient oversight? My point being that it's not just one person, you know, it's not one candidate or one party that decides we're going to redistrict. That has to be a process that goes through, I would think, at least two or three layers of oversight and get, you know, a rubber stamp that, yes, we can. Therefore, if there is gerrymandering, it has to be complicit on several levels. I guess I just don't fully understand the redistricting process and how it fails to sway the vote, in the largest sense, rig an election. I'd love to hear more about how it works and how there are several layers that it has to go through, and there has to be complicity on
right.
at least a couple of those layers. And I'll take it off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Dave Robertson, how does it work, and why isn't the process more impartial based on whatever rules are set up?
Well, because there's no federal rules about this. There are rules that say population has to be equal if you have at least two districts. And remember, there are seven states that only elect one U.S. representative and two senators. Those are statewide votes. That has nothing to do with gerrymandering at all. For the 43 states that do have more than one representative, it's really up to the state, except for the requirement of equal population in the district and the Voting Rights Act requirements. Beyond that, it's up to the states. Like so much else, we don't understand how much power the states have to make all of these rules. And if they want to have a new election commission or a new process for gerrymandering, California implemented that. That's a model for other states. But Illinois and Missouri are not ready for that, apparently.
So Dave, you're saying states can impose rules on itself for how they conduct redistricting.
Absolutely. They can impose rules on themselves. They can do it through initiative process, and that's part of what we're trying to do in the state of Missouri with the Clean Missouri initiative. But whether or not that passes is a really open question. Whether it passes muster in the Supreme, in the courts is another question.
Yeah, Jason Rosenbaum, we just have a couple minutes left. I wanted to go to the other aspect of this, which is that the U.S. Supreme Court is now engaged in this process. I mean, isn't this something of a surprise? Because the court, at least traditionally, has been reluctant to engage in redistricting because it's such a political process to begin with. Do I have that right, Jason?
I think so. But I have also asked, like, how the Supreme Court case is going to affect states like Missouri and Illinois. Because as we mentioned on the outset, Illinois engages in partisan gerrymandering to help Democratic candidates. So I would wonder if the maps there would be more amenable to Republicans. In Missouri, though, I think the impact may not be as large because the first congressional district in Missouri is a minority-majority coalition. And there's going to be a lot of opposition among the Democratic Party in St. Louis, especially the African-American community, to making that district less African-American and spreading that population to other districts, and which is, I think, one of the only ways to make some of the surrounding congressional districts more competitive.
Hmm.
So I think that the courts would probably have some hesitancy about changing the maps that made the first district less African-American.
Yeah, I would reckon that from the Democrats' point of view, the most that they could expect from drawing the lines differently would be one seat anyway. That's kind of the way I see it.
I would agree with that.
Dave Robertson, just we have less than a minute here. The U.S. Supreme Court is now looking at a case from Wisconsin, looking at a case from Maryland. Is there a betting line as to where the court might go here?
No, I think it's really open because of what Jason said. The court doesn't want to step on the procedures of the states, but at the same time, the outcomes in some of these states are so serious that they're beginning to feel that for the legitimacy of the Republican system, that with a small R Republican, they need to do something. So I think it's a really open question as to which way it's going to go.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. That's Dave Robertson. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science over at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio, who focuses on Jefferson City. Gentlemen, as always, thank you both very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk, revisit our conversation with Keyser Khan. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, author George Saunders told us about the influences behind one of 2017's most acclaimed novels, that's Lincoln in the Bardo. Find that and other previous shows at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, he plays 35 instruments, composed the music for 1962's The Manchurian Candidate, and has shared the stage with musical greats. David Amram is a man with stories, and he'll share a few with us. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, now let's listen back to a conversation from November of last year with Keyser Khan, who shot to national prominence in the summer of 2016 when he stood before the Democratic National Convention and lit up the hall. Let's begin with a bit of what he said that night in Philadelphia.
Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
Keyser Khan was at the convention as a Muslim American Gold Star father whose son, Captain Humayun Khan, was killed in Iraq in 2004. Captain Khan had stopped a taxi loaded with explosives at a checkpoint, stepping forward so that other soldiers in his command didn't have to. Keyser Khan has written a memoir about his life and what America means to him. That book, An American Family, A Memoir of Hope and Sacrifice. He joins us now from the studios of St. Louis Public Radio. Mr. Khan, welcome to the show.
Well, good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
You almost didn't make that speech at the Democratic convention. Why did you hesitate?
When the invitation came, I immediately asked our other two sons, should we go or shouldn't we go? We are private, humble, modest people, not familiar with the after effects and what it takes to be at such a public forum. That was the hesitation initially, and we were advised, do not go. Your reputation, your peace, your integrity, everything will be questioned and challenged. And by nature, the people that know us told us that this is not your cup of tea, so do not go. So we pondered for 2 days, should we go or shouldn't we go? And we sat in the room where Captain Humayun Khan's picture is hung on the wall, and just trying to get some sense. We are people of faith and some guidance. And we almost made the decision that we really should not go. But then one event made us go, and we explained that in the book.
You got a letter, right?
Yes, from what was taking place, that bigoted statement that was made earlier in December of 2015, we will ban all Muslims, all Hispanics will be thrown out because they are criminals. Judges are partial, women don't deserve equal dignity. And so whenever we would go to various birthday parties of small children, our children, neighbors, and small kids of elementary school, middle school, parents knew that I practice law, would reach out to me and would say, is this true? Our children are being bullied. And these are the children of all races, all color, all faith. And in school, children are being bullied by, they're being told, oh, you will be thrown out of here. So don't worry about studying or coming to school. And children don't sleep, don't eat well, don't want to go to school. So this was, and I would hearten them. I would read them the Section 1 of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, that we are equal, with equal protection, with the due process, and no, you will not be thrown out of here. And they would humbly ask, they would say, can we finish our elementary school? But we don't know where we will go because we were born here. Our parents are born here. We just look different. Is this the reason for us to be thrown out of here? So I would hearten them, and some children will be heartened and some will not, and they will still remain worried. So the second day I went to check the mail, and we almost decided what was kept us going, pondering should we go or shouldn't we go, was that question of these small children that had asked me. And we just did not have the heart to simply say, no, we really want to keep our peace and our quiet and our modesty at home. We don't want to be part of it. Their questions. So I go to check the mail second day in the afternoon, and I find a card in the mailbox, and it was written by 4 students. They put their name of the school on top of the card. And this was the sentence that sent us to that national convention and has helped us continue speaking even today. And the sentence said, Mr. Khan, would you make sure that Maria is not thrown out of this country? We love her. She's our friend. Even today, the power of that sentence,
yes,
so innocently written on behalf of Maria, still keeps us going. So I brought that card immediately to Ghazala and showed it to her. I said, look, we've been praying. Some guidance should come. Here is the decision. And she looked at me with eyes welled and said, call them. We will go. And we went, and we have continued since then.
Author, lawyer, and 2016 Democratic National Convention star Keyser Khan is my guest. At the end of your speech, you urged all immigrants to not take the November election for granted. At the time you spoke, it appeared that Hillary Clinton was well on her way to the White House. Some might conclude that they did take the election for granted. And I'm wondering how frustrated you are as a result.
Well, majority of this country did take it seriously, and they voted. But we are, of course, disappointed, heartbroken, and disheartened. not just for the sake of one candidate or the other, but for the values and the dignity and the status of this nation throughout the world and among ourselves. The division and the hatred of one another based on faiths and religions and race is a defeated, is a harmful notion that perverts in our nation today. I have spoken to 170 plus communities throughout the country. This nation is fully acknowledging the values of our founding documents, our declaration, our constitution, our Bill of Rights, that unity is the solution. The hopefulness that this nation has is the solution to this division that exists, that is colored by the malice from overseas, from the foreign hands. So, yes, we are heartbroken, we are disappointed, but I am very hopeful these 170-plus speaking engagements throughout the world, throughout the country, by invitation of various organizations, religious, political, social, citizens' organizations, bar associations, have given me hope that this nation is fully realizing that the prosperity and the solution to the hatred, to this division, lies in our firm belief in our founding documents, in the dignities that are enshrined in our Bill of Rights. I purposefully call these values that are enshrined in our documents human dignities, that entire world aspires to have these dignities in their life. We are fortunate to have them guaranteed to us, and we must protect them. That was the mission of Captain Humayun Khan. He was so truthful to the oath of office that he took to protect others, to care for others. So,
I want to go back to your book because it's something very different than what we're talking about here and right now. It's your story, and it's full of wonder. It's full of optimism about America and everything this country has represents. When you were a boy growing up in Pakistan, tell us about the first time you came across our Declaration of Independence.
I was 22 years old, 1972. I had taken a course in comparative study of world constitution and constitution of Soviet Union. Yes, Russia used to be Soviet Union, and Constitution of Germany and Magna Carta, the British foundation of their legal system. And then, of course, our blessed three documents, Declaration of Independence, Bill of Rights, and our articles. The very first page of those materials, when I brought them from the printer and placed them at the desk in my dorm room, was this: the Declaration of Independence. And I was awestruck in that. What is this nation that is declaring its independence? Independence in colonized world is given. You complain, you beg, and you ask, and you protest and all that, but there is no nation that declares its independence. So I have been in awe of our Declaration of Independence since then, and then I saw the signatures of those brave 56 men and women that signed the Declaration of Independence so proudly, their full name and their state and their counties. And it was just an awe-stricken moment in my life, and I have been in awe of those sentiments. All 1,338 words, all 18 grievances that were declared, that were the foundation of the Declaration of Independence. And I implore America to read it one more time. And you will see the wisdom of our forefathers, the wisdom and the price of that sacrifice, price of that independence that that forefathers paid for us to have these liberties and these freedoms that we cherish so very much. For me, it is even why I am so passionate about this is this. I have lived twice without these liberties. I have lived when newspaper people would be shot if they published something that was not pleasing to the dictator in Pakistan. Twice in my life I have lived under martial law. I could not go and buy a bag of rice or bag of sugar without the ration card given to me. And I could not come out of the house unless the administrator will give permission for people to come out. Having lived that, to these liberties, why wouldn't I be so passionate in defense in telling America to read these documents so we are well aware, so we can protect and preserve these liberties?
And this wonder as a young man aimed at our Declaration of Independence comes from a young man who, as a boy, would listen to your grandfather recite Rumi, Beneath the Moonlight. And it's such a powerful image to me. Which of his words stays with you to this day?
Well, so many.
So many, sure.
But I tell all of that in the book in great detail. But I used to sleep under moonlight, not out of fancy, but because we did not have electricity. So that was not a choice. But we made the best of those lake of resources, meaning that he would come and he would tell me stories and he would recite Rumi, whatever he could remember. And there are a couple of quotes that I write in the book. Mm. One is, this was his favorite quote, "Be a river, so what if you're thirsty yourself?"
Yeah.
"Be a river for others."
That's meaning, in the book, yeah.
Meaning your generosity should not stop. Lack of resources should not be reason for you to not be generous to others. And the second that had stayed with me all of my life is that a person is not complete unless person's education is complete. And it is that quest that brought me to United States and took me all the way to the blessed halls of Harvard University. And life has continued ever since.
Keyser Khan is my guest. Again, a star of the 2016 Democratic National Convention. He has a book out, An American Family, A Memoir of Hope and Sacrifice. You mentioned coming to this country and going to Harvard. Did you ever, as a boy, in your wildest imagination, ever think you'd wind up here?
You know, I used to read these documents. First, I read the Declaration of Independence. Then I read the articles. Then I read the most important part of the document of the Constitution, our Bill of Rights. At that time, I did not have the caliber or courage or capacity to even dream. I was in such an awe. Are there people that have these guarantees, have these documents implemented? Everything made sense after I read the Declaration of Independence. The articles made the sense. That is how civilized people live. This is our rule of law. And then, of course, the Bill of Rights. So at that time, I did not have the caliber, courtesy, or dignity, or courage to dream that one day I'll be able to go and see those people. But later on, it began to come together that I must see them. There must be some impact on their daily life, on their character, of these wonderful values that are enshrined. And sure enough, even today, all this goodness that prevails in this country, the generosity, the open-mindedness, the acceptance of others that we experience every day is because of these founding documents and the values that are enshrined in these documents.
Mr. Khan, tell us about that moment. And there are a couple of different accounts of this moment in the book. When you opened the letter from Harvard telling you that you had been accepted, because obviously a life-changing moment.
Yeah. I was momentarily just in amaze. Amazing high that, my God, I could only dream of being a student at Harvard University, and all the instruction of my grandfather are about to come true. But immediately after that, the reality set in. How would I afford all this? Would I be able to even go? Would I be able to pay for that education? And then, of course, his instructions always encouraged me that he used to say with that, that lack of resources should not be any reason for you to not pursue your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that that brought us here. But momentarily, there was a high and then there was a reality, the lack of resources. How would I afford it? How would it all come together?
Yeah.
And it came together.
Mr. Khan, I've got about a minute left, and I want to get to maybe, in my mind, the most important quote in the book. You write that, "I'm an American patriot not because I was born here, but because I was not." Pretty
yes.
powerful.
Yes. The story of the book is really, it's a story of all immigrants. It's not only just a story. We simply are the carrier of the message, but the message is of all immigrants, that we go through to become American, we struggle to become an American. I quickly will tell you the experience that I had when I became citizen, and I want every American to read the oath of citizenship so that we can defend our values. I go to the court with full realization that I have no dignities that are enshrined in documents. The oath is taken place, and I'm given a certificate which says Certificate of Citizenship. In tears in my eyes, I look at that title. To me, that means, and I'm looking at that green piece of paper, and it says to me, Certificate of Human Dignity. And I walk out with all the things that I have dreamed as a human being guaranteed to me as a citizen of this country.
Right.
So it's been an amazing journey.
Mr. Khan, what a pleasure. Thank you very much for the time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted.
That conversation with Gold Star Father Keyser Khan was from November 2017. Well, every other Monday, KCUR contributor Greg Eklund joins us to review the sports storylines that are catching his attention, and today is that Monday. And Greg, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve. Nice, warm, cozy studio here.
Not bad compared to the outdoor conditions. The big story right now, of course, is the Olympics. Are they tuning in as much to the games compared to 2014?
Well, Kansas City has a strong viewership, and I would say, considering that nobody probably went out on Saturday night, considering the weather advisories that were going on at that point, that a lot of people stayed home, and when they were staying home, they were watching the Olympics around here. Overall, though, NBC is not off to a great start on the television side this year because, again, Kansas City is very strong with its viewership, but the lowest, the Super Bowl that NBC had, registered the lowest ratings since 2009. And then with all the money that NBC is investing into the rights fees, NBC was obviously hoping for some, especially with all promotions that were taking place during the Super Bowl, that is, the Olympics would help make up for the lower numbers during the Super Bowl. It has not happened in the early portion of the Olympics
so far. But it's
so
much fun to watch.
It is.
Get a huge kick out of it.
It is. But overall, they are lower than they were in 2014 in Sochi.
Well, there was an historic moment last night in figure skating. What happened there?
Well, that was when Mirai Nagasu performed the triple axel in team competition. So with individual competition around the corner, we might see it again. Hmm. But she was the first American woman to do it in the Olympics. Hmm. It had been done by an American before.
Tanya Harding.
I happened to be there for that. That was
really?
In Minneapolis, 1991, U.S. National Championships. And, of course, then we knew what had happened in the years ensuing when Tanya Harding and the whole Nancy Kerrigan thing played itself out, and she had never done another triple axel again in competition.
Hmm. Great movie out, I, Tanya, that tells the whole story.
Yes.
I really got a kick out of it. Well, there isn't. This isn't shaping up to be, you know, I guess a fun-filled season for KU and K-State fans. What's going on with these teams now?
Well, from the fans' perspective, it provides an interesting viewpoint from the outside looking in on the Big 12 race and the SEC race as far as Missouri is concerned, too. But with KU and K-State in the Big 12, K-State was on a roll there for a while, and K-State had a bad loss at home. I shouldn't say a bad loss because Texas Tech is a good team. They've shown it. They beat KU at Allen Fieldhouse. Texas Tech is in sole possession of first place now in the Big 12 Conference. So instead of being the leader, as 1 week ago KU was, KU now is the chaser as the Jayhawks look to try to win one of the two road games that they had in their current swing. They lost badly at Baylor on Saturday. The Jayhawks play against tomorrow night at Iowa State.
Not an easy place to play, even though Iowa State's not doing that well.
And Iowa State beat Oklahoma at home over the weekend.
And K-State?
And K-State has a home game against Oklahoma State on Wednesday.
Things seem to be faring a little bit better for fans on the other side of the state line. Tell us a bit about the Tigers.
Yeah, the Tigers are on a bit of a roll now. Four in a row, they had an overtime game against Mississippi State on Saturday afternoon at Mizzou Arena that they almost gave away. They lost a 12-point lead just in the last 2 minutes of the game. Mississippi State forced the overtime, but the Tigers pulled it out in overtime. So they, again, are at home tomorrow night against Texas A&M. The Mizzou women, meanwhile, are also doing very well. They beat Kentucky last Thursday night, and they were supposed to play yesterday in Arkansas, but because of weather conditions and travel problems going down to Arkansas, that game has been postponed until tonight.
So the Tigers are hanging in there even without Michael Porter.
They are. They're forming into a nice team. It's a team that is learning about how to play with each other because they have so many newcomers on the team. In the meantime, Michael Porter at a news conference last Friday afternoon says that he's not totally ruling out the possibility that he may yet come back this season. He says he feels good, but he's got a six-week checkup coming up when the doctors will determine that.
Okay, different sport entirely. Now the Royals are headed out to Surprise, Arizona this week for spring training.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Kind of a fitting name, isn't it? Since the team's lineup, but still may surprise us, right?
Well, that's true because there is so much uncertainty going down to Surprise, Arizona. It could be who's here today and gone tomorrow because today Kelvin Herrera is the closer. Tomorrow he might be gone. If there's a team willing to take him on, the Royals might be willing to unload his salary and try to restock their farm system as they are in a rebuilding mode. They'll tell you, though, that they're going to rebuild and try to win at the same time. They don't want things to drastically fall off as they had in the past.
How come there's so much uncertainty this year? I mean, is this typical, Greg?
Well, no, not at all. It's atypical because of the uncertainty still of so many free agents out there who are waiting out for a better offer. Eric Hosmer, Mike Moustakas being among them. There's still a possibility that the Royals could land Hosmer. Probably more doubtful for Moustakas. It looks like Chesler Cuthbert is probably the future third baseman, and at least for this season.
Lots of grumbling in Major League Baseball from the players that there's collusion going on here. The owner's not willing to pay the big salaries, and some players are really upset. That might cause labor unrest in the weeks to come.
It's probably the agents who are most upset because we're not hearing too many comments from the players, and all the talk that's coming out are coming from the agents. They're the ones. And it's not like, there are great offers on the table. It's just that the guys like J.D. Martinez and Jake Arrieta are hoping for better offers.
Is there a chance we're going to see Hosmer back in a Royals uniform this year? How likely is it?
There's a chance. Again, and as we've said all along, it's up to him. I think there's going to be a lot of transactions taking place while the team is in Surprise, Arizona. Eric Hosmer's decision's probably going to be one of those.
So he could start out in Surprise and start the season. He doesn't have a contract right now.
Right. I mean, he's working out probably at his home in Florida right now until he decides to sign with a team.
Well, that's KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund filling us in on the world of sports. Greg, always appreciate it. Thanks very
Steve.
Much. If you missed any of our conversations, including last week's about keeping the legacy of the Buffalo Soldiers alive, you can find them in podcast form. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me, at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, musical legend David Amram joins us for a conversation about a career that spans more than six decades, including a stint as the U.S. Goodwill Ambassador of Jazz. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.